And a very good morning to you. It's John Fradgley from the Bell Legal Group back with you for another program of The Law and You this Tuesday morning. Your opportunity for free legal advice between now and 9:30. All we need you to do is get on the telephone. 55208888 is our number. That's 55208888. 07 in front of that if you live south of the Tweed River. And don't forget, we do have an email address if you're not able to make a call. We can answer those questions next week. The email address, talkback@4crb.com. But we have someone who's been very quick out of the blocks this morning, and we say a very good morning to our first caller, Vicky. G'day, Vicky. How are you today?
Oh, good morning, John. I so love your program.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm phoning for a dear friend who's close to 80, and she's asked me to speak for her.
Sure.
For 20 years, she's owned, managed and maintained 7 shops and a storage facility and her residence in an outer Brisbane suburb.
Yep.
She would like to sell, given the length of ownership of the business. An exemption from capital gains would seem to apply, according to the ATO site. Mm-hmm. However, this exemption does not apply if the business is the rental of shops to business owners. And I'm wondering if an alternative exemption exists.
Right. Well, first of all, you said that she's owned the that property for 20 years. Is that right?
She has.
Okay. So it's well and truly after the date on which capital gains tax was introduced in Australia, which, of course, was September 1985. So
right.
She's well outside of that. Your principal place of residence is exempt from the application of capital gains tax. So if she's living in part of the property, then that's exempt. There are also certain exemptions for active business assets, and the storage sheds may be regarded as an active business asset.
I see.
So there may be additional exemptions there. Quite honestly, Vicky, what I would be recommending your friend do is contact her accountant and go through the whole process with them about what exemptions can be claimed.
Right.
If the accountant is more a person who simply prepares the tax returns rather than someone who feels comfortable in giving tax advice, then it may be necessary for her to get advice from another source. And the accountant very well may be able to refer her to a chartered accountant firm that or a CPA that deals in taxation advice.
Right.
And that would probably be the best way to get the appropriate advice, because there probably are a number of exemptions there that she can use. And it's only by exploring each one of them as they apply to the particular property that
to
be able to maximise the exemptions available to minimise the potential capital gains tax.
I see, John.
Yeah. Now, don't forget, though, also that when you do ultimately work out what the capital gain, the taxable capital gain is, part of that process is the is that there is a 50% discount on the actual gain before the tax is calculated. So there are a number of things there that may be of assistance to her.
Oh, thank you.
All
the 50% discount, irrespective of length of ownership, is it?
Yes, it is.
Oh, I see.
Yep.
I see.
But I definitely would be recommending that she speak to her accountant in the first instance, if he doesn't feel comfortable to give the advice, get some good tax advice from an accountant, who I'm sure her accountant would probably have someone that they refer these sorts of matters to if they don't deal with them themselves.
Sadly, no, but she'll have to search for one that herself.
Yes.
Yes. Well, right. Thank you, John. I appreciate that.
All the very
thank
best.
You.
And the time on 4CRB just is rolling along. It's just coming up to 10 minutes past 9. The Law and You is the program, 55208888, the number, as we say good morning to Robert. G'day, Robert. How are you today?
G'day, John. Thanks for being there.
No trouble at all. How can I help you today?
Oh, I've got a question about property titles, if I may.
Sure.
When you've got a property with no mortgage and there is a tenant in there or other people have access to it, how do you stop an illegal transfer?
Right, well, you're talking about a property in Queensland?
Yes.
Okay, yes, because you're probably referring back to the fact that the Australian government of, the Queensland government have recently abolished paper titles.
That's correct.
So they no longer apply. Look, the way that it is now governed is certainly, it is extremely difficult for someone to fraudulently transfer a property because although there's no longer a need to produce a the title deed, there are now very strict protocols that apply in relation to the identification of all parties to a transaction. So there needs to be identification of the seller to the satisfaction of the lawyer acting for the seller. There needs to be identification of the buyer to the satisfaction of their lawyer. And then there are also identification requirements and declarations in place in relation to the transfer. So that all being said, Robert, no system is absolutely foolproof, and even the system that has paper titles is not foolproof either, because people identify properties that, for example, are owned by overseas owners sitting there vacant and have in the past conducted fraudulent transactions in those matters. We did have a call the other day about whether it's possible to lodge a caveat over your title, and although it is although the legislation permits the registered owner to lodge a caveat, you need to have a valid reason for lodging that caveat, and so it would be a matter of exploring with the titles office whether your fear of fraud is a sufficient reason to allow it. But if that were not the case, and you weren't able to lodge a caveat, one other thing you possibly could do would be to lodge a mortgage over the property yourself.
Yes.
And just put a mortgage on it with $10 on it, so that there is in fact a mortgage in place on the property. There's no stamp duty on mortgages in Queensland. There would be a registration fee of around about $190, but the existence of that mortgage would certainly preclude a sale without securing a release of the mortgage as well, which would just interpose yet another step. All right.
Well, one of the concerns was somebody borrowing money against the title because the title didn't have any mortgages on it, you see.
Right, okay. Well, in that case, if a lender was silly enough to lend money on a title, on a property, and without sufficiently identifying the borrower, then the mortgage would be invalid. And there'd be a bit of inconvenience in getting it taken off, but the mortgagee would certainly lose their money. And as long as you can prove that you are not the person who put the mortgage in place nor borrowed the funds, which should be pretty easy, the lender is in a serious position.
I did speak to the titles office about it, and they're basically saying very, very similar things to you, but you're explaining it much further than they did, of course. But they also said that there was a protection in place by the government, some sort of indemnity.
Yeah, there is a guarantee for fraudulent transactions, so that if someone fraudulently transfers a property and the government registers the transfer, and it was an unlawful transaction, then there is an indemnity scheme in place. That's quite true. But that's one you hope you don't have to use.
Well, this one raised its ugly head because a tenant came in and wanted to pay 6 months in advance, and then in return wanted to see the driver's license of the registered owner, you see. And it became, when I became aware of it, it just became a huge question mark, that's all.
Well, look, I suppose being the devil's advocate here, Robert, it's probably not unreasonable if someone's going to pay 6 months' rent in advance that they want to make sure the person they're paying the money to is actually the owner of the property. So asking to see, for example, a copy of the rate notice for the property and a copy of your driver's license is probably not unreasonable if you're going to pay 6 months' rent in advance.
Thank you for being there. It's excellent to hear you on Force ARB every now and then.
Thank you very much, Robert. Good to talk to you.
Have a good day.
And you the same. And the time on 4CRB has just passed 15 minutes past 9. 5520 8888 is our number. That's 5520 8888. We have no callers online at present, so if you have a question or a query, get on the telephone right now, and we'll be right back after this word from our sponsor. Pretty sure I know who that
is. Tasman Healthcare, based at Southport, is one of the region's most advanced cancer care centres, providing personalised treatment plans for their patients, which are then delivered by a medical team of oncologists, haematologists, genetic counsellors and professional cancer care nurses. If you've been diagnosed with cancer, ask your GP to refer you to our sponsor, Tasman Healthcare, or call 56132480.
And this is The Law and You on 4CRB. Our telephone number is 5520 8888. We presently have no callers online, so if you have a question or a query, a cold morning like today, you can give us you can get straight through 5520 8888. While we're waiting for some calls to arrive, there were a couple of things that just caught my eye during the week, and or caught my ear and or my eye. And one of them, of course, was the announcement of the gun amnesty for Australia, which I now understand is going to be a permanent gun amnesty, which means that people who have unregistered firearms in their possession or illegal firearms in their possession are able to surrender those weapons to either a licensed gun dealer or alternatively to the Queensland or the state police in the particular state they're in. So that's very good news. There are a few other issues around that, which I'll talk about perhaps later in the program. But in the meantime, we have Rhonda on the phone. Hello, Rhonda. How are you today?
Very well, thank you, John. And yourself?
Not too bad at all. How can I help you today?
John, I have a couple of questions, please.
Sure.
One, is it necessary to do an enduring power of attorney, Form 4, if I have in place an advocate health care directory and a statement of choices completed?
So they're New South Wales forms, are they?
No, they're Queensland ones.
Oh, of course.
The healthcare advocate is Form 4 and the statement of choices is Form A.
Right, okay, because the forms that I'm familiar with are the Advanced Health Directive, which does
have... Oh, that's
right,
yeah, advocate.
The Advanced Health Care Directive does have in the back of it provision, I think from memory, to put in place an attorney for personal and health matters. But
right.
I'm not 100% sure that it actually enables you to put in place an attorney for financial matters.
Right, okay.
So in that case, you would need... I have seen people who have done an advanced health directive and then they've done a standard EPOA, but only for financial matters to complement the one that already was put in place in the advanced health directive. So just double-check the forms, but you're probably not fully covered for both personal and financial matters if you're using just the EPOA, the advanced health directive form.
Okay, right. Fine. Now, and also, whilst in relating to these cases, I haven't got my attorneys as such signatures because of this COVID thing. They're all in New South Wales. Is it possible for them to run off the signature copy, sign it, and send that back to me, or does it have to be done on the real form, on the original form?
It should be done on the original form, but you don't...
Right.
What you can do is you can do it by post, but what you could do is you could photocopy all of the form with the exception of the page they have to sign, because they don't have to have their signatures witnessed, and then you can send the whole form with the original of the signing page they need to sign to them, and then when it comes back, put the original page back into the original document.
Fine. Okay, then.
Right,
well, thank you so much for that.
Okay, then, Rhonda.
And in due course, I'll have to sign up and come and make an appointment to see either you or one of your partners to get all this organised for me.
Well, I'd look forward to meeting you.
Thank you, because I haven't done my will yet. Aren't I naughty?
Dear.
Ooh.
Help me, Rhonda. Then. Help me.
Thank you, John, and I enjoy your program very
Thank
much.
Thank you, then. Bye-bye now.
Thank you kindly.
Time is just past 21 minutes past 9, as we say. Hi to Gary. G'day, Gary. How are you today? Gary, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, Gary. How can I help?
Yes, good morning. I was just thinking, in a couple of days, a new list of businesses that are required for the QR code, such as shopping centres and movie theatres and that, come into play. Mm-hmm. My question is that a business that is not on the list, that is not required by Queensland Health, and they want you to tap into their QR code, under the Trades Practices Act, can they refuse you service even though it's not required by Queensland law?
Very simple answer to the question, Gary. I don't know. I haven't had reason to look at it. I should imagine. I've certainly been to businesses that are using external login systems, and before the QR codes really became quite common, it was very common to go to a cafe or a restaurant or something, and there were a number of registration sites that were obviously websites set up by people to do that. And basically, I think all you put into it was your name, your mobile phone number, and in some cases your email address. I didn't have any problem with doing that, so I haven't had reason to look at it. It's the same as writing your name down on a sheet when you arrive at a business, and in fact, in the nursing homes, you know, I go and visit my mother, and the nursing home has its own login system that you've got to sign into. So I don't really have a problem with it. As to whether they would be breaching the Trade Practices Act in refusing to serve you, I don't know. My suspicion is that they probably aren't, because I don't know that it's an issue that comes under the Trade Practices Act.
Yeah, I was just thinking, because it wasn't law, you know, for an example, a nut and bolt shop down the back of Mudgery Bar, you know, that says, well, you can't come in unless you've signed the QR code.
Mm.
And it's not required by law, and it's not required under the Health Act. So, you know, sort of, can they do it or not?
Well, I think they can say to you, well, look, it's one of our conditions of entry that you do that, and if you're not prepared to adhere to it, then we're sorry, but we can't serve you. I think that's unreasonable.
Yeah, well, okay then. Okay, thanks,
Gary,
very much. Thank
all you. The very best. And we say a very good morning to our next caller, Sally. G'day, Sally. How are you? Sally,
Hello,
are you there?
Thank you.
Yes, I'm well. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
How can I help?
I was just got a question over DNA testing.
Yep.
In the instance where a couple are separated, in fact, a couple are separated, and we've tried to obtain a copy of the birth certificate and since found out that the father is not listed on the birth certificate, we've been advised the only way to have your name added or check parentage is to get a DNA test. What's the legal situation for somebody who wants to get a DNA test on a child that they believe is theirs if you don't have the other person's permission?
Well, does the child come into the custody of the other parent from time to time? Okay, well, I don't see any reason why you wouldn't be able to you know, take a swab or get a COVID, get a DNA testing kit and take a swab of that child while they're there and send it off. I think the other alternative, unfortunately, is that you have to, if you want permission off the other parent and they're refusing, you have to get a court order.
To get a DNA test, because birth, death, marriages have said that we need to have a DNA test or get the other parent to consent to add, and that's not happening.
That's often a very big problem to get the birth mother to agree to put the name of the father on. But if you're in a situation where you've got regular access to the child, I don't see any problem in simply getting a swab and doing that.
No legal problem to go.
Not that I can see, no.
Right.
As long as it's not going to cause any distress to the child. How old's the child?
4.
Oh, right, so only a young child. All right. Yes. Well, look, DNA tests can be done off any number of things. I mean, for example, I think from what I understand, a child blowing their nose on a tissue will supply DNA material. So it's probably worth speaking to someone who does DNA testing just to find out what's required. Sally, leave that with me, and I might just comment on this next week, because just given that the age of the child, I might just double check, because I don't want you rushing off and taking DNA material from the child if in fact it's not permitted to do so. But I'll comment on that next week for you if you like.
Yeah, we just need a copy of the birth certificate to enrol the child at school. So
right. Has the father got permanent custody of the child?
Not yet.
Hmm.
No.
So what is the father trying to get permanent custody?
Well, there might be a situation where she'll end up in his custody if the mother's incarcerated. So.
Right, okay. And all right. And why would the father be enrolling the child at school?
Because that would suggest
that the child is going to be in the permanent custody and control of the father.
Yeah, well, the mother just isn't enrolling her.
Hmm.
She's got to be at school next year, so we want to get her into kindy and school, and it's just not happening.
Hmm.
So we want to put things in place.
All right.
Have that
Sally, happen. Sally, can I ask you to just take down a phone number, please?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so the number is, have you got a pen there?
I've got one.
Okay, because this sounds like it's fairly urgent.
Yep.
So the number is 5597-3366.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to ring and ask for Margaret Miller, who is one of the partners at Bell Legal Group, who specialises in the area of family law. And if you just tell her that you were speaking to me on the radio and that I asked you to give her a call, she will be able to give you a chapter and verse on the spot.
Oh, that's all brilliant. Right. Thank you so much.
Okay, Sally.
Thank you.
All the best. Bye now. Time is quickly approaching 9:30. We've got two callers. We'll try and get to them. Lynette, g'day, Lynette. How are you? Lynette, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Lynette. How can I help?
Oh, hi. How are you, Doc?
I'm well.
I've got a family law question too.
Right.
18 months ago, our son was given sole custody of his two children with sole parental responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And after a 7-year battle in the family court, only seeing them at contact centres. Now, he has the children.
Mm.
He works on the Gold Coast but has been offered a position in Brisbane.
Mm-hmm.
What is the legal situation with him moving? If he can still guarantee that the mother can, at the moment she can only see them under supervision,
mm-hmm.
if he can still guarantee that the children are still, the mother still can see the children when they're supposed to, which at the moment is every second weekend for 2 hours,
mm-hmm.
can he move to Brisbane without her consent?
I would think he could.
The children are 8 and 11.
Mm. As long as she knows that he's moving to Brisbane, I don't see any problem with that, because he's not going to be interfering with the with her right to see the children. If he can guarantee her right to see the children at the times that are designated, then I don't see a problem with that at all. I would certainly be letting her know that he is moving to Brisbane.
Yeah, at the moment she sees them for 2 hours once a fortnight, and it's up to our son as to when that escalates to maybe seeing them for a few hours or one day on the weekend.
Mm.
There's the judge never made a time limit on
that. Yes, right.
So if and I think the mother thinks that she's going to have them 50-50. Well, if he moves to Brisbane, he can't do that because of schooling.
Yes. No, that's right. So that's going to be a matter to go back to the court and be decided by the court at that time.
Right, but he can move to Brisbane at the moment if he feels he needs to. Okay, thank you so much for that help.
Okay, Lynette, all the best. And finally, we say good morning to Ennis. G'day, Ennis. How are you? We'll have to be quick. We've got the news coming up.
To Brisbane at the moment, if you will.
Can you just turn your radio down, please?
Okay, Lynette. All the best.
Hello, Ennis. Are you there?
Yes.
Yes. How can we help?
Oh, John, I've got two children.
Mm-hmm.
And if one of my children dies...
Mm-hmm.
And our will states that they each get one share each. Mm-hmm. Where would the money go, or where would the inheritance go if one died?
It will go to the children of the one half would go to the surviving child, and one half would go to the children, if any, of the deceased child, unless you've specifically excluded issue from benefiting.
Yes.
And if you haven't, and if the child who dies has no children, then the whole of the estate, unless there's some other residuary clause, the whole of the estate would end up with the surviving child.
Oh, that's good. Mm. And we don't have to have anything in the will to say anything about
anything. As long as your will says, I leave my estate to such of my children as survive me, and if more than one in has tenants in common and equal shares or something like that, then it's not a problem.
Oh, good.
All right, then.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Ennis, all the very best. And that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us for The Law and You. I look forward to being back with you again next week. But as always, until then, goodbye and God bless.